Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
The previous speakers on Talk of the Bay were a group of people understandably frustrated, probably running out of money and very worried about whether or not we've gone overboard. And they are promoting peaceful disobedience to some of the strictures of our current shelter in place. So I want to start off by just saying that peaceful disobedience is premature. And I had prepared remarks based on an article that came out this week. And so let me explain before I drop into this. I'll just say that the COVID-19 is real. I don't think that any of those people were denying its reality. But I don't think they understand the ripple effect or a concept I'm about to talk about. So it's been worth it. And I've been following the French newspapers and what's been going on in France, because France is about 3 weeks ahead of us in terms of their experience with the virus. And they had a very, very tough lockdown. I mean, it was, you needed a basically a permission from the local prefecture to go grocery shopping. It was absolutely not that you were going to get to go and run along the cliffs at the beach or anything like that. It was you could exercise. It was within a very short distance from your house. It was very strict. It was very strict, and it was very successful. Before I go any further, I need to explain a concept called the basic reproduction number, or basic reproduction ratio. It's usually referred to as the R0. It's R with a lowercase subscript zero. If you're from England, you call it R0. And if you're from the United States, you call it R0. So what is this? Well, R0 is the expected number of cases that are going to be generated through spread from one sick person in a population where no one is immune. Now, obviously, there are variables such as population density, the use of crowded public transportation, how long does the virus stay active on surfaces, if it's a virus, or the bacteria, if it's a bacterium. And so all of these things affect the spread. COVID-19 virus has an R0 ranging from 2 to 5.7. So for reference, the measles R0 is 12 to 18, and chickenpox is 10 to 12. And here's the key. The proportion of the population that needs to have had the disease or been vaccinated to prevent an outbreak is 1 minus 1 over R0. So that's the proportion of people that need to be immune before you don't get an outbreak. And it's based on, you know, how strong is the virus. And what the French did was, through their very strict quarantine, they were able to bring their R0 down from 3 to less than 1. In fact, down to 0.67, a 77% reduction by that full quarantine. But now they're going to be opening up, and there will be a second wave. So my recommendation is watch the news for what happens in France, because their society is very analogous to ours in many, many ways. And do your social distancing and your masking and see what happens there in the next 3 to 4 weeks before you make a decision about the social disobedience. Now, I predict that the social distancing and the masking will be enough to prevent major outbreaks. But the hard part's going to be these continued safe practices. Now, let me tell you about the beach ban, because I think that people do not understand its purpose. And its purpose is basically to discourage people from Santa Clara, which has a much higher number of active COVID cases, and therefore a whole bunch of asymptomatic people, from coming to the beach over here and infecting you, contaminating your surfaces. This is a real thing. Now, we said 3 days on plastic, door handles, buttons, banisters, the bottom of the rail that you use to get down to the beach. And how are you going to wash your hands? It's non-trivial. I might add that once you have virus on your hands, if you play games with balls that are touched by multiple people, then that becomes a vector, very much like the mosquito is a vector for a virus. And 3 days on plastic and no running water, no hand washing stations at the beach. It really is a potential problem. And the main thing is the beach tourism. And yes, that's really hard on the economy for people who depend on that. But there's nothing harder on the economy than a whole bunch of people being sick at the same time, particularly the ancillary stuff that happens. And we've talked about this, and I don't want to belabor the point. But I do feel it's premature. I would encourage people to not go to any civil disobedience events, no matter how inclusive or how non-political or any of the above that there are, because it's too early for us to be doing this. The French aren't entirely sure that it's not too early for them. We are behind them. And it really is an issue. So I hope that this helps you understand. Let me tell you a story about continued safe practices. I was in the bank the other day. I had to go in person. And I'm very, very careful in my practices. But I was so pleased to see at the entrance to the bank a board with a bunch of masks on it, a security guard, and a big thing of hand sanitizer. And the ask was, you know, do you have a mask? Have you cleaned your hands? If the answer is no, here's a mask. And I want to encourage small businesses as you open up to get a supply of masks if you can. There are various organizations that are making them. They're broadly available online. You can get them for a fairly nominal price. Consider it part of your overhead to, if someone wants to come into your business and they don't have a mask, let them have one. I think that will be a very, very wise thing. And another wise thing that is starting to happen is that we are starting to have testing. We have now testing. Anyone in the population who wishes to get a test can make an appointment at the testing center in Ramsey Park. We are suggesting that if you're just idly curious and you feel well, maybe you should stand aside for another couple of weeks. But we do have testing capacity. It's starting to be actually available. And the people who are at high risk or who had an illness, or maybe they're starting to feel an illness, but they aren't really very sick yet. It's time to reach out to your doctor and get instructions, because the testing is now starting to be much more available. And as people are hospitalized, they are tested. We are starting to get where we need to be to allow for that opening in reduction. But we don't want to blow it. And that's just it. If we get an outbreak now, we blow it. And we don't get to open up further. And if we stay on the path that we're on, because I just listened to the public health officer, Gail Newell, talk about this yesterday morning. If we stay on the path that we're on, we're looking at like early June for stage three, which is basically just about everything's opened up. And if you can't social distance, you wear a mask. We need to get to stage three as quickly as possible. And I know it's hard. It's hard to think that, oh my God, I've got to wait another 2 weeks. Please wait another 2 weeks. Don't blow it. Please don't blow it. Because if you do, you blow it for everybody. And just hang in there, okay? Please. So we're moving to Shaul in Israel. Shaul's a longtime listener, and he writes, cleaning vegetables. Dear Dr. Don, what is the best way to clean fruits and vegetables from all health risks like pesticides, bacteria, germs, and viruses? According to the FDA, all we need is water. Well, first, Shaul, I want to invite you to go look at the Environmental Working Group website. They have a thing called the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15, and it lists those vegetables that have the highest level of pesticides. And those are the ones where if I'm not buying organic, I am cleaning because I don't want to eat those pesticides. So the Dirty Dozen are things like, well, cucumbers, if you peel them, you're good. But there are a number of other vegetables, celery being a big one, that has a lot of pesticide on it. So if you can't buy organic, you're going to want to clean it. With respect to bacteria and viruses, the same thing we've been using to spray down our surfaces can work on our food surfaces. So I have a technique to recommend that will cover you for viruses, bacteria, mold, and as far as the pesticides are concerned, it's pretty darn good for those too. So you make up a dilute solution of bleach, and that solution dilution is 4 teaspoons per quart or liter of water, or 5 tablespoons per gallon they have on the CDC website, and throw some soap in that. Dish soap works well. You want just enough dish soap that when you agitate the water, it sudses up a little bit. Not very much, actually, for that. Put all your fruits and vegetables in a colander and drop it into that water mixture in a basin. Or if you've got a double sink, you can just plug both of them and do it. And let it sit for 1 minute. Then rinse. Now you can rinse just by rinsing off the stuff with water, or you can pour it into a different colander and drop that colander into plain water and agitate it. Then remove and sniff. If you can't smell anything, you can do a little tongue test and see whether or not it tastes soapy. If it doesn't, you're good. You've cleaned and rinsed your vegetables. I do use this technique, by the way, for strawberries, and it works quite well and doesn't really mess up the fruit. I'm very paranoid about pesticides and pollutants, so I've been doing this with the soap for quite a long time. The bleach, of course, is a recent addition to deal with the COVID. Our next email is from Ellen in Sausalito, and Ellen writes, good morning. I enjoy listening to your show and wish you were located in the Bay Area. I will soon be 67. I'm 5'2" and 118 pounds. I eat lots of organic veggies, quinoa, black beans, wild-caught salmon weekly, lots of blueberries. I'm in good health and very active by hiking and walking. I've been on thyroid medication since 1988 for hypothyroidism, and I suffer with migraine with aura. So my annual blood tests are normal except for cholesterol. I'd like your opinion on these results. My primary doctor sees no problem, and I got worked up for extreme fatigue in 2018, had myocardial perfusion scan and a treadmill, and was then told I have no demonstrable fixed or reversible perfusion defect to suggest chronic or reversible ischemia. So I'm looking now at Ellen's results, and she has a total cholesterol of 2. So we're going to walk through the analysis, okay? Total cholesterol is 277, HDL 73. So 277 divided by 73, that's roughly 3.0, actually a little less. Anything in the threes is low risk. So let's move on to the next risk factor to look at, triglycerides. Now, triglycerides typically are high when HDL is low and vice versa. In this case, the triglycerides are low at 65, indicating as well a low risk for diabetes and inflammation. Just by the triglyceride number, I can say probably she doesn't have any insulin resistance. Isn't that cool? LDL, 138, flagged as high, not really very bad. And her glucose is 83 and her inflammation is low. So, Ellen, you're in good shape. And you're 67. The number that I treat for a woman in your age group for LDL is 190. If I'm going to give drugs, in the person does not have other risk factors like high blood pressure, I'm waiting till it really is a problem. Now, most of the time I'm able to help people lower their cholesterol through natural means, and I don't think that you necessarily have to do that, but if you wanted to do something in addition, some fish oil, probably about 1,000 milligrams of eicosapentaenoic acid, which is EPA, would lower that LDL cholesterol. I want to emphasize, I don't think you need to do that, but if you have a lot of aches and pains that where you'd get some benefit from the fish oil, it wouldn't necessarily be a bad idea because it lowers inflammation in a very upstream and healthy way. I hope you found this helpful. Remember, you can email me right now at onair@ksqd.org. And just a little announcement. I wanted to just let you know, for people who have Netflix, my husband has become very enthusiastic about awesome nature videos. They're set to music. There is no words. They are like those old relaxation videos that used to be around in the 80s on some of the cable channels, where it's just beautiful music and beautiful nature. So it's on Netflix. They're called Moving Art, and they are really, really gorgeous. I highly recommend them if you're needing to take a chill pill. Sitting down and watching some of these will definitely get you there. And there are times when we all need to take a chill pill, especially nowadays. Our next email comes from Richard. He's in Michigan. And Richard writes, I hear a lot of hype about NAD+, and it sure sounded like a good thing for most people, but it seems to me there are reasons to avoid it. I've been overweight for years, doing pretty good now. I've done keto for weight reduction, but now I'm eating lots of high-fiber veggies, and I enjoy salmon. By the way, parenthetically, Richard, that is a fabulous strategy. Lose weight on keto, and then pivot to salad and salmon, because salad and salmon, or high-fiber veggies and low starch, is what keeps you from gaining the weight back. It's highly sustainable. Let's get back to the question. I heard basically sales pitch style comments about NAD, and it sounds like niacin in general, but it seems like there's potential problems with increasing insulin resistance. And you are quite right. The niacin dose that starts to increase insulin resistance is about 500 milligrams to 1,000 milligrams. And the NADH is being promoted as being good for energy, and I do not generally recommend it. So I do not feel that there is sufficient persuasive data to want to go there. So our next email comes from Mary in Santa Cruz. Mary writes, what do you think of the Pepcid and COVID paper? And she sent me a link with this, which took me to consumerlab.com. And I took a look at this link, and it's a Q&A thing on Consumer Lab. So let me give you the backstory. Famotidine, which is Pepcid, is an H2 blocker, and there was a paper that was discussed in the journal Science in April 26, 2020. That's the only published paper, and it's not a scientific paper. It's just sort of a review, retrospective review. Doctors in China were looking backwards at people and who had COVID, and they looked at 6,200 records, and they found that there seemed to be some advantage to people using this. They had hospitalized patients who had been on famotidine at the time of their hospitalization, or or those who received it IV within 24 hours of admission were 70% less likely to have died within 30 days of admission. This benefit was not seen with other acid blockers, and there was no information about whether the other H2 blockers, Zantac and Tagamet, would have had the same benefit. What's interesting to me about this, Mary, is the mechanism, the possible mechanism by which the famotidine may work is actually completely accidental. It has nothing to do with acid. It inhibits an enzyme, maybe, called 3-chymotrypsin-like protease, or 3-CL-PRO. And this is essential for processing the proteins needed for viral replication, maybe. Now, this information comes from computational modeling. And, you know, what's computational modeling? And I thought I would take a moment to kind of talk about that. So this is how remdesivir and hydroxychloroquine were kind of floated up to the surface as things that might work. And it has to do with using very sophisticated computer designs to look at the DNA ends of something and come up the shape of, let's say, an enzyme, and then come up with what sequence of DNA might fold into something that would interfere with the function of that enzyme. So you first have to determine the shape of the protein. And once you've determined the shape of the protein, you can start taking the shape of the drugs and literally just kind of sticking them up next to each other in an exercise of fit. Now, that's very time consuming. And now it's done by these sophisticated supercomputers very successfully and very quickly. So this is a new thing. And in fact, this is also being used in the vaccine research. And parenthetically, I do plan on bringing back next week a science lesson on vaccines and vaccine production. There's been a real revolution in how we do vaccines. And I think that you would all be interested in maybe doing a little bit of deep dive into what may be, prove to be a historically convenient moment for a major scientific breakthrough. But more on that next week when I've had a chance to do my homework. I don't quite feel able to present it to you in my in the clearest possible way, because it is a complex subject. I also want to talk about the vitamin D connection, both in reference to some of the remarks made on Talk of the Bay and also to this concept of interfering with the adverse results of a severe COVID-19 infection. And this research was just published a couple weeks ago. The researchers at Northwestern University analyzed patient data from 10 countries, and they found a very strong correlation between vitamin D levels and a hyperactive immune system. Now, it's interesting because vitamin D actually strengthens innate immunity. It makes your innate immunity stronger against a virus, but it prevents overreaction. And when they looked across countries at vitamin D rate, they found that that having low vitamin E, that is to say deficient vitamin D levels at admission were doubled, 200%, doubled your risk of having a immune system overreaction, or what is called a cytokine storm. I think everyone should probably get their vitamin D levels checked and try to get their vitamin D levels at least in the 30s. I would recommend in the 40s or 50s. I believe that that is a good target. It's hard to do that unless you are spending a lot of time lying on the beach or on your roof. And of course, tanning beds are not an option at the moment. So supplements may have to be the way you do it. I do believe that there is sufficient data to suggest that supplements will do the trick here. as far as getting those levels up and providing the immune mitigation and modulation that we're after. I have a topic pivot now, and we are going to talk about the surprising effects of oxytocin on cocaine addiction. This research came out earlier this year, and it was from the University of Southern California in a journal called Psychopharmacology. They revealed that oxytocin, a hormone that's produced naturally in the hypothalamus, has significant gender differences when it's used as treatment for cocaine-addicted individuals with a history of childhood trauma. Now, it has been shown to have therapeutic action in addiction across the board, reducing cravings, and so that's important. We don't really know how it influences craving, but they measure cravings by showing someone who's gotten clean their cocaine paraphernalia. So wanting to understand how extremely traumatic events in childhood might be an effect here. This is very much known that when you have childhood trauma, particularly when it's extreme, there are neural changes in the brain that predispose you to all kinds of addiction. And the location of the neural changes from the trauma overlaps the locations that we see in addicted individuals. This particularly is true of an area called the amygdala, which is kind of part of our lizard brain, I guess. Well, you could say that it's more rat brain. There's lizard brain, and that's basically keeping you breathing and getting your heart going. There's rat brain, and that's fight or flight and emotions. And then there's mammal brain, which is thinking and remembering. So the amygdala does a kind of remembering, and it's becomes very hyperactive in response to stress, but it's very rich in oxytocin receptors. Oxytocin, by the way, is also the feeling that you have when you're in love. It's the hormone causes milk to be secreted by the breasts of a postpartum woman. There's some interesting self-medication use out there, and I'm not going to go into it, but oxytocin is available for use and is being studied very thoroughly for drug addiction. So in men with a history of trauma, when they did their experiment of showing them drug paraphernalia and having them score their cravings, they gave them either oxytocin or placebo, and then they looked at the activity in the amygdala and the person's subjective cravings, and the people didn't know whether they'd gotten it, and they found that it was effective. But this was interesting to me. This did not hold true for women with a history of trauma. And the women just did not respond to the visual triggers, and when they were given oxytocin, their brain actually became more responsive rather than less to these triggers. We don't understand the differences, the sexual dimorphism of brains, and this is probably part of the reason that we should look more carefully at sexual dimorphism in our science, because if something like that can be different, I wonder what else is different that we haven't bothered to test. By the way, most lab rats of the rat variety are male, and we are beginning to understand that we have missed the boat for decades of research by not also testing female rats who often respond differently in experimental settings. Before we leave the amygdala, I just want to share with you a friend of mine many years ago had a bumper sticker that said, "Bad amygdala." And indeed, the amygdala can definitely steer you wrong in situations where the cortex goes offline. Our next story, also around addiction, refers to cannabis addiction. And this a study looking at CBD capsules for treating cannabis addiction. So, you know, cannabis is thought of as a non-addictive drug, but actually about 1 in 10 people can become physiologically dependent on it and have withdrawal symptoms of anxiety. And while I would call that physical dependence and withdrawal and differentiate it from addiction, they used addiction in this story. So some people have been smoking very, very high levels of cannabis in the last few years because of the paste and the concentrations and the hybridization. And some people can become very, very addicted and actually have withdrawal symptoms. There's a syndrome which I've missed and finally figured out I have to ask about, called cannabis withdrawal hyperemesis syndrome. And essentially what happens is that when people who are regular daily smokers slow down, they get very nauseated. Remember, it's an anti-nausea drug. And so the settings for nausea, in order to keep you safe, because nausea is actually a defense mechanism, have been shifted by the brain in response to an anti-nausea drug. And as a result, they will experience extreme severe vomiting. And the clue to this, if you have it or you think you've been having episodic vomiting and you had no idea what was going on, try taking a very hot shower. And if the hot shower helps and you've been smoking a lot, you may have actually gotten yourself into this loop and you need to cut down. Okay. So about 400 milligrams of CBD given to people who were heavily dependent was able to slow the amount that they used compared to placebo. The highest dose of, 400 milligrams is a magic number if you are trying to get out from under. And that's a pretty hefty dose of CBD, but CBD doesn't cause, it's relaxing, but it doesn't cause levels of intoxication. And the same team is going to start looking at using this high-dose CBD during alcohol detoxification, because two of the main features of alcohol detox are seizures, sometimes called the DTs, and severe anxiety. Well, CBD works for severe anxiety, and it's a known anti-seizure agent, particularly at high doses. So this over-the-counter agent in sufficient concentration has the potential to be very beneficial in treating addiction. I think probably the reason that it works so well is that it slows the metabolism of THC, both your ingested THC, but also your own natural endocannabinoids like anandamide. And because that is slowed down, you're not going to have the cliff effect where you just suddenly drop. And when people are high-level smokers, they upregulate their cytochrome P450s that break down THC, so they can burn through a lot of it. And when they finished burning through it, they fall off a cliff. Now, just while we're on CBD, I'm going to hark back to a paper that I just ran across, sent to me by a friend of mine who's a grower. I had asked her to send any interesting cannabis stories along that she saw. And this popped into my mailbox the other day. In Search of Preventative Strategies, Novel Anti-Inflammatory High CBD Cannabis Sativa Extracts Modulate ACE2 Expression in COVID-19 Gateway Tissues. This was a really interesting paper, and I'll just encapsulate it for you. First of all, I want to say, yes, they had placebos. It's tissue culture. They screened about 800 different cannabis lines and extracts. And they did this on artificial, I love this, I didn't know these existed. They created artificial 3D models of oral, airway, and intestinal tissues, all of which are known to contain fairly high levels of ACE2 receptors. And they wanted to see whether or not these receptors, which go up when there's inflammation. See, ACE2 is actually part of the inflammatory modulatory pathway. It downregulates excessive inflammation, so it's triggered to increase by inflammation. And normally, that's a really good thing. But part of why I think we see the cytokine storm in COVID is because this important break on the inflammatory response is actually being damaged by the virus itself, and by the virus essentially preventing it from doing its job of releasing a host of anti-inflammatory immunomodulatory compounds. So they were looking in the right place, and they grew fake mouths with fake tongues and fake bronchioles and fake intestine using human tissue culture models. We've talked about how these 3D scaffoldings could be used and seeded with cells. Well, this is actually happening now in research. Then they looked at whether or not these modeled organs, which are living tissue, would be modulated by these high CBD extracts. And what they found was quite impressive. They found some very significant down regulation of these products, and also of something called serine protease TMPRSS2. And this is a critical protein that's needed for the entry of SARS into host cells. So basically, you got less docking stations for the virus when you gave the stuff, and you also got less of the enzyme that's critical for the virus to be able to change its shape so that it can close pin onto the docking station. I'm very excited about this. I'm going to try to get this fellow to come and give us an interview because I would love to hear more about this research, and I thought that you might be interested as well. So it all ties together, my friends, in a really, really fascinating way. I have one more substance study and better living through botany. This one about medical psychedelics. This article comes from about 4 months ago. It was in The Economist, and this was a story in The Economist about companies making drugs that essentially will legalize, or if not legalize, mimic psilocybin. Now, we know about Peter Thiel and Compass Pathways, which is a startup in London that wants to be the first legal provider of psilocybin. And we do have some psilocybin being available here for experimental work in severe PTSD, and that's being done actually by a local group here in Santa Cruz County. Other people are looking at ketamine as a treatment for severe depression. And of course, cannabis has been, shall we say, a gold rush here in California, with a great deal of money suddenly being made in the suddenly legal cannabis industry. What happens if psilocybin becomes legal, and where would those trials be done? there is a place in Canada that is called Field Trip Ventures, and they are going to operate specialty clinics where for $1,000 you would get a therapist and a one-time dose of psilocybin that would, and a trip that would last all day and be guided. And at the end of that experience, one hopes it would have proved to have been worth the money. This may, when we can travel again, this may lead to a certain amount of psychedelic tourism. It'll be interesting to see how these industries develop, and interesting to see what anyone thinks of this. So staying on the mental illness thread, contaminating a fake rubber hand could help people overcome OCD. I think we've all become, we've basically all had to assume the mantle of OCD, but people with OCD actually suffer from a mental illness where they feel that their body is contaminated, that especially their hands are contaminated, even from touching something as commonplace as a doorknob. Well, it's actually not a mental illness at the moment, but it is very common. And I do worry about my patients who already have a light version of this and how they are managing under this COVID-19 epidemic. It can lead to damage to the skin, excessive hand washing behavior. It can also lead to repetitive behavior. And it's usually treated with a combination of drugs like Prozac and some kind of therapy, talking therapy, sometimes exposure therapy, where you expose someone to a contaminated surface but don't let them wash their hands. But it's extremely stressful for people, and they have a hard time taking part. So you can't always get people to sign up for it. So these researchers, this is just totally bizarre, and it's amazing that it worked. But rather than having people contaminate their own hands, they gave them a fake rubber hand. What do you say? A fake rubber hand? Well, this goes back to something called the rubber hand illusion. And this is a thing in psychology. An individual places both hands in front of them on a table, and there's a partition, so they can't see their right hand. And to the left of the partition, rather than seeing their hand, they see a fake right hand. And the experimenter strokes both the fake hand and the hidden right hand using a paintbrush. And after several minutes of stroking the individual off, they stop stroking the hidden right hand, and they continue stroking the rubber hand. And the individual will often continue to feel the stroking sensation at that point. It only works if both hands are stroked in synchrony. If they're stroked, you have to stroke all three hands and then drop away the right hand. But in a number of psychiatric conditions, it appears to work without stroking the left side. So that's really interesting. Maybe the body image is different, more malleable than healthy individuals. So these researchers thought, well, let's use healthy volunteers. And once they got the illusion going, they contaminated the dummy hand with fake poop. And they did this study after 5 minutes of stroking, and they were asked to rate if they felt like the rubber hand felt like their own. And then they smeared some fake poop on the hand and put a damp paper towel on the real right hand to create the sensation of the contaminant being smeared on the real hand. And then they asked them to rate their disgust, anxiety, and their hand washing urge levels. And it worked. The people who were in the experimental condition were disgusted, but they were not as disgusted as their normal level, and they were able to continue with the therapy and successfully get past it. It took about 10 minutes after contamination, but at the 30-minute mark, those who had the fake hand procedure were doing very well. And the idea is that this might allow us to use this. And just, I wanted to share this with you because that fake hand is such an odd illusion. And I'm sort of tempted to want to try it. It is very intriguing to me that the brain sort of develops a connection through repetitive conditioning and believes that it's actually being touched. We've all been trying to figure out how to get exercise This is a little off topic, but it's fun, and I think we could all use some fun tonight. Special shoes that can make you run faster. So University of Vanderbilt in Tennessee basically modeled the energy used in running, and they found that the leg only supplies about it supplies energy only about 20% of the time that the foot's on the ground. So they developed spring-powered shoes that would increase the amount of power a person's legs generate while running, and it would allow the leg to supply energy 96% of the time, because, of course, this energy, which is kinetic when your foot strikes the ground, would be stored as potential energy in the spring and then released. This probably would also be very, very helpful for people with bad knees. I would imagine that the spring is going to act as a cushioning device as well. They were analyzing the running style of the 100-meter world record holder Usain Bolt. His top speed is 12.3 meters per second. Theoretically, they could get his, these shoes could get him up to 20 meters per second in running speed. And that's something I want to see. That's definitely. I hope they make those shoes and give him a pair, because I want to see that. Okay, gut bacteria. Yeah, I can't do a show without talking about the microbiome. Are you kidding, guys? Gut bacteria may cut infant food allergy risk. If a mother has certain microbes in her gut, her baby's less likely to develop food allergies. Prevotella copri is a bacterium that makes fatty acids out of dietary fiber. These are called short-chain fatty acids, and they're very important in nourishing your intestines. It's actually the food supply for your colon. Isn't that cool? The bacteria in your colon ferment fiber and turn it into food for the cells. Now, that's what you call a symbiotic relationship. You know, I'll keep the house up. If you make the wall, I'll keep it healthy. So in mice, we've known for a while that you can reduce allergic reactions with a high-fiber diet. And so they looked at this. Those short-chain fatty acids that are made by our commensal bacteria help regulate inflammation. Now, we don't have that study yet, but you know that too much inflammation is something we all want to avoid. So eating your fiber is probably an excellent idea. And I'll get therapeutic for you before I finish talking about the study and just say, eat a root vegetable once a day. Try to vary them. Root vegetables are awesome for providing this kind of fiber. So for that matter, are artichokes. So they looked at a study of Australian mothers and infants. And they looked at fecal samples from the moms at 36 weeks pregnant and from the infants at 1, 6, and 12 months after birth. And then they looked at the samples of kids with food allergy and compared them to those of 236 infants without allergies. So they had samples from both groups. And about 20% of babies without any allergies had the P. copri in their samples, but only 8% of those with allergies. So the more that the P. copri was in the mom's stools, that Prevotella seemed to reduce the hit rate for allergies in the kids by quite a bit. So it isn't very common in rich countries. And where do you find the most infant food allergies? Rich countries. So maybe someone needs to figure out how to grow this stuff and make it a product, because unfortunately right now you can't. However, as I said, root vegetables, particularly raw root vegetables, are going to be your best strategy. So carrots or beets, scrubbing the carrots really well, but not peeling them, and grating them would be my strategy, and adding that to your salad or lightly steam it, don't steam it. Don't cook it, because you'll get more bacteria if you don't. These soil bacteria actually get into the root vegetables, and you don't want to eat too much soil bacteria, but a little bit of dirt might actually prove to be therapeutic. One more study about children that I want to share with you tonight. Some children who experience stress in early life develop adult-like brain networks and show signs of aging more slowly. Now, that's interesting. This was a group at Stanford University, and they tracked 214 children over 2 years, aged 9 to 13, and they asked them, had they witnessed or experienced a range of stressful events? I imagine it was sort of like someone dying or a car accident. And then they each gave a saliva sample, and they looked at their telomeres on the ends of their chromosomes. And then they looked at they studied these kids again, back to the amygdala. They analyzed how their amygdala interacted when they were shown pictures of adult faces expressing various emotions. Kids, in children, the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex tend to fire together, but in adults, when the prefrontal cortex, that's your higher brain executive functioning, is active, it tends to reduce amygdala activity and helps keep emotions in check. Children who experienced more early life stress tended to show a more adult pattern of brain conductivity. In other words, they matured early with respect to the prefrontal cortex, helping them control their emotions. 2 years after the brain scans, these children who had witnessed traumatic events seemed to be progressing through puberty a bit more slowly, and their telomeres were blunted and shorter compared with their peers. Now, we've already had studies looking at telomeres in women who are taking care of children who are disabled, adult disabled children. So these are the moms who have a child with some sort of physical or mental disability that they are caring for. And we know that they have much shorter telomeres than their age-matched equals. And we also know that when you are caring for a child with cancer or other terminal disease, the same thing happens. Your telomeres get shorter and shorter. So what can we say about this? We can say that the brain and the DNA are both affected by life experience, and these are both adaptive and maladaptive responses. And perhaps what we should be doing with this is protecting our children from as much as we can from childhood stress, letting them be children as long as possible. And certainly providing robust mental health services. Let me say that again, because we don't have this in this country. Robust mental health services for any child who is subjected to a traumatic event. I've done a whole series of artistic pieces called Emotional Baggage that showed last year at during one of our first Fridays, all about the stories that patients have shared with me from their childhood, because I ask, and most doctors don't have the luxury of time to do so. So I'm not dissing them. I'm saying, when you ask, it's amazing what you hear, and it's amazing what people have to carry. So I just want to finish by putting out a request that we all be kind to each other, whether we're being kind to adults or children. Kindness saves lives. It saves brains. It lengthens telomeres. It amplifies itself. And this is a time when we're all stressed, and it's very easy to forget to be kind. So I want to encourage everyone to do random acts of kindness and not so random acts of kindness. I want to encourage all of you to do something especially nice and unexpected for somebody every day, just as a spiritual practice. I think you will improve the collective herd immunity by making people a little bit happier. And we can all use that.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.